Hello and welcome to the Friday edition of American Hit Radio. Yay!
Yay, the happiest happy hour.
Exactly. Friday, 5 p.m. What's better than that? Glad you tuned in to spend some time with us. Thanks for coming aboard. Today is a rather momentous occasion. It's been a long time coming.
Uh-oh.
68 weeks, actually. But this is the show where we play the last officially recorded music by the Beatles that was made while they were still a band. So you could technically say this is our last show. I will say, though, that we do have to do a postscript. I want to talk about the disassemblage of the band after this point in time. And while doing that, I can play some of the tracks that were compiled after the Beatles had broken up. There's a movie medley. There was the album Love, the entire album, really. And those couple of tracks that were compiled by the three living Beatles using John's tapes that were placed on the anthology. So we'll cover that stuff in an upcoming show or two to totally close this out. But this really is officially the last show, because this is the show where we cover the last side of the last album that the Beatles recorded while they were together. And you know what? It's doubtful that a more fitting ending could have been concocted by any band ever. At the time, people weren't quite recognizing exactly the significance of it because, quite honestly, there was an album that came out after this. Let It Be came out, was released about 6 or 7 months after Abbey Road was released. But that's only because those sessions were put in the can and on the back burner. The band really didn't necessarily think they were going to release them at all. So if you arrange it chronologically, as we have, this is it. The Beatles were in the studio. They more or less, you know, it was not overtly understood that this was the end. They didn't talk about it. They weren't standing in the studio looking at each other and saying, okay, you know, one more take and we're done. You know, it's over. You know, bye, everybody. It was more or less the unspoken truth. You know, sessions were, comparatively a pleasure. Compared to what they had gone through for the past couple of albums. It was possibly because they could each sense that the incarceration of being a Beatle was about to come to an end. I know George felt that way. It was like he just couldn't wait to be done with the imprisonment of it. And John eventually got up to having that same mindset. Ringo, of course, would have been more than happy to see the thing continue, but he understood. He could see what was happening, and he was getting a little bit frustrated by it all as well, as was Paul. You know, Paul definitely wanted to try to keep it going, but there was no way that was going to happen. So what we're going to do for this show, that's going to be a little bit unusual compared to our others, is side two of Abbey Road is really technically one very long piece of music. It consists mostly of what has come to be known as the Sun King medley.
Right.
All the songs that pretty much from Sun King till the end of the album all blend together. Now, as we normally do this, Heidi, you know, of course, what I like to do is, you know, give out some information on a track and then play the track so that the information that we're providing is, you know, obviously provided with the song.
Right.
It would be a really lousy idea to do it on side two of Abbey Road because we'd be stopping this medley right in the middle of it to talk about it or to talk over it.
Right.
And one ruins it artistically and the other one demeans it artistically. So rather than do that, we're going to basically cover all of the information for the first half of our show that I have. And then, you know, hopefully I won't run out of breath between now and 5:30 as I give you all this information. And then sometime after that, we'll be able to just play side two in its entirety. And it might be interesting. You might have fun hearing it for the first time after you hear this information, because there's an awful lot that I'm going to be able to tell you about a lot of the tracks that are on this album. Me and the Beatles themselves, I'll be quoting them as well. Well, the first thing, I guess, to know about the album is that when it was released, it sold 4 million copies in its first 2 months of release. And so it was selling, obviously, incredibly quickly. When the Beatles disbanded, by the time they had disbanded, the album had already sold over 7 million copies worldwide. And it does, to this day, remain the best-selling album that the Beatles ever released.
Huh. How about that?
The sleeve was based on an idea about that Paul had about simply going outside to have the band's picture taken right there outside of the studio, because it would be less of a hassle. It was designed by the Apple Records creative director, Kosh. It is the only original UK Beatles album sleeve to show neither the artist name nor the album title on its front cover. Just a picture. A few other interesting things. To the left of the picture on the zebra crossing where the Beatles are walking, there's that Volkswagen Beetle that had the license plate that read allegedly 28 if, you know, which was the big clue about whether, you know, what Paul's age would be if he was alive. If you look closely, the license plate actually reads LMW 281 F, and after the album was released, that guy's license plate was stolen repeatedly. Every time someone would see the car, they'd steal his license plate. In 1986, that car was sold at an auction for over £2,500.
Wow.
And in 2001, it was actually on display in a museum in Germany.
Crazy.
It's just a Volkswagen, but it was in that photo.
It's a special one.
This is interesting, too. The man standing on the pavement to the right of the picture, his name is Paul Cole. As it turns out, he's an American tourist who was completely unaware that he had been photographed until he saw the album cover many months later. It's like, oh, look at me, I'm on the Beatles album. Now, discussing the tracks themselves, we'll just run through them in order with some interesting information and quotes from the band. The side starts with Here Comes the Sun. It was George Harrison's second song on this album, which was sort of a nice thing, because George normally wasn't getting two songs. But after the White Album, it was more or less George was getting more songs because George's songs were better than they ever had been. In fact, they were fantastic. Some would say that George's songs were the best songs on the record. Such a great album, it's really hard to say. But let's just say that George's songs were not wanting at all in comparison to the Lennon-McCartney songs. Here Comes the Sun was as I said, was the first song on side two, his only other song other than Something, which appeared on side one. And here's George Harrison's comments about it. Here Comes the Sun was written at the time when Apple was getting like school, where we had to go and be businessmen, sign this and sign that. Anyway, it seems as if winter in England goes on forever. By the time spring comes, you really deserve it. So one day I decided I was going to sag off Apple, and I went over to Eric Clapton's house. The relief of not having to go see all those dopey accountants was wonderful, and I walked around the garden with one of Eric's acoustic guitars and wrote, Here Comes the Sun. Pretty interesting. Now, another interesting fact, John Lennon does not appear on this track at all. He didn't contribute to the song because at this point in time, he was recovering from that car crash that he had, so he missed the sessions. The backing vocals are actually made by McCartney and Harrison, recording their own backing vocals twice to give the track a fuller sound. Harrison then added an electric guitar, which was run through a Leslie speaker, and the orchestral parts consisted of two piccolos, two flutes, two alto flutes, and two clarinets were added, and the whole song was completed within 4 days with the addition of Harrison's Moog synthesizer part, which he was adding to quite a number of the songs on side two, as you see as we go forward. Here's a very interesting fun fact about the track. Astronomer and science popularizer Carl Sagan wanted the song to be included on the Voyager Golden Record.
Oh, very cool.
If you remember, it was in the late 70s when they...
Yeah, they just put a Beethoven piece on it, right?
They put a bunch of stuff. Chuck Berry is on there, and I really can't say for sure what else. But there's a bunch of different people saying hello in different languages.
Right.
It was intended to be representative of the human race at that point in time. And it was just going to be drifting through space forever, figuring that, you know, with the romantic notion that someday some benign and friendly beings in the universe somewhere will happen upon Voyager, and after laughing at its quaint technology, would figure out how to play this golden record. Remember, now we didn't have CDs yet, so it was literally a pressed vinyl record.
Right.
With gold.
Gold-plated.
Gold-plated, right. And they'd figure out how to play this somehow, and I'm sure that then discover what life on Earth was like at this point in time in the 70s. Well, anyway, copies of the of that record were attached to both spacecraft of the Voyager program to provide any entity that recovered them, representative of a sample of human civilization. And although the Beatles liked the idea of being on it, EMI refused to release the rights. And when the probes were launched in 1977, the song was not included. What were they worried about the rights of sending the song into space for?
Yeah, some alien might
mess up their copyright.
Might release it without paying royalties.
In Alpha Centauri or something?
Yeah.
You know, like, what are they? Talk about, you know, overthinking, you know, rights protection.
We can't have some alien plan.
What if they come back singing the song? Oh, it'll be horrible. It's nuts.
That is nuts.
Oh, the next track on the album, after Here Comes the Sun, is the track Because. That was written by John Lennon, of course, credited to Lennon McCartney. All of the songs on side two, though, were written exclusively by one member of the Beatles. And then, you know, credited as they always would be, Harrison's songs to himself, anything written by Lennon or by McCartney at this point, and like I said, written completely on their own, were credited to both Lennon and McCartney. Three-part vocal harmony was put together by Lennon, McCartney, and Harrison and overdubbed twice to give the track a full effect of 9 voices on the song Because. The electric harpsichord on the track is actually played by the producer, George Martin, and he's accompanied by John Lennon's guitar, which is also played through a Leslie speaker, as Harrison's was on the previous track. Also, its track also features a Moog synthesizer played by, once again, by George Harrison. The Beatles were among the first in rock and roll to experiment with the Moog, but among the first. They might have been the first to really incorporate it and to fold it neatly into their music, mm-hmm. rather than using it as a blaring sort of an effect. But up to this point, the bands, famous bands that had used the Moog before the Beatles, include The Doors, Simon and Garfunkel, and believe it or not, The Monkees were among the first ever to use it on their track Daily Nightly. According to John Lennon, the song's close musical resemblance to Ludwig van Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata was not a coincidence. According to John, here's a quote, "Yoko was playing Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata on the piano, and I asked her, can you play those chords backwards? And then wrote Because around them. The lyrics speak for themselves. No imagery, no obscure references. Simply John writing over Yoko playing the chords in reverse to a Beethoven number."
Hmm.
This was because of overdubs. This ended up being the last song that was to be committed to the tape for the album, although there were still overdubs for other tracks. And Paul McCartney and George Harrison both said that the song Because was their personal favorite track on Abbey Road. Following that, then, leads us into You Never Give Me Your Money. This song was actually a medley in itself. It's a medley within a medley, so to speak, because this song consists of at least 4 distinct sections that are unrelated. It's a type of writing style that Paul McCartney would visit a couple of times. He would do it in his solo career with Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, where he'd complete one part of the song, move on to a different section, and really not revisit the first part again, or maybe just hint at it. So that was happening with You Never Give Me Your Money, too, and it sort of set up the idea of what was to come with the longer, more complex medley of different tracks. The riff that is featured in You Never Give Me Your Money is actually, although it comes before the Sun King track, which I said everybody calls it the Sun King medley, You Never Give Me Your Money comes before that, but it really should be included as part of the medley because the riff of You Never Give Me Your Money returns during the medley. In the middle of Carry That Weight, the song comes back again with new words. It repeats there. Once again, on this track, there's prominent use of Leslie amplified guitar parts, something that's fairly common. So if you're really going to try to replicate the guitar sound on this album, you'd do well to be putting your guitar through a Leslie amplifier. I don't know if you know what a Leslie is. A Leslie, just to explain it in case you don't know, is literally a rotating speaker in a cabinet. So it gives the sound a very unique effect. A Leslie is commonly used with organs, but there's no reason why you couldn't play another instrument through a Leslie cabinet. And that's exactly what the Beatles were doing here. That then brings us to the actual medley, Sun King. Now, as I said, in my opinion, the entire album qualifies as a medley. The entire side two. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Forgetting the fact that up to this point, we've only had three songs, and now the medley already begins proper. But of those three songs, the first song is called Here Comes the Sun. And the very first line that John sings in the Sun King medley is, Here Comes the Sun King. So naturally, that ties the first track in, folds it in with the rest of the medley. The other reason is that the song that we mentioned earlier, Because, with its really rich harmonies and nine-part vocals, is repeated here on Sun King as well. It's more or less the exact same type of vocal approach that they used on that track. And I guess finally also the last reason, besides Here Comes the Sun and Here Comes the Sun King, is the fact that You Never Give Me Your Money is spread throughout the medley as well. Well, on the song Sun King, the one thing you might notice when you're singing along with this song is how the Beatles suddenly break into some really strange combination of languages at the very end. This bizarre mix of romance languages that they just throw together, like mucho, obrigado, chica fairy, mi amor.
Mi amore, corazón.
Right. Basically, this is Lennon saying that he was actually interviewed about the lyrics, and he said, we just started joking, you know, singing cuando, para mucho. We just made it up. Paul knew like only a few Spanish words from school, you know? So we just strung any Spanish words that sounded vaguely like something. And of course, we got a chickaferdian. That's a Liverpool expression. Just like, it doesn't mean anything to me, but it means like na, 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 somehow. Another noted aspect of the song is its use of cross-channel phasing or stereo panning and fading. If you listen closely, the guitar line slowly moves from the right channel to the left channel and then back again. This occurs in the beginning of the song and then again toward the end. In an interview in 1987, Harrison said that the record was actually inspired by Fleetwood Mac's Albatross. At that time, Albatross was out with all the reverb on the guitar. This is Harrison's quote. So we said, let's be Fleetwood Mac doing Albatross just to get going. It never really sounded like Fleetwood Mac, but that was the point of origin. Now, speaking of that panning left and right, by the way, this is one of the last two Beatle albums that were released were never released in mono, which is to say Let It Be and Abbey Road are available only in stereo because mono was being phased out at this point in time. So if you were to buy the Beatles mono box, it will be without the albums Abbey Road and Let It Be. They do not exist in that box because there's no such thing as a mono version of these two albums. All right, then, moving on from Sun King. Boy, there's so much to talk about. The next track, Mean Mr. Mustard, a song written by John Lennon. I'm confusing myself. Anyway, the medley from Sun King into Mean Mr. Mustard was actually recorded as one continuous piece, which shocks me because that's the part that sounds most like an edit. That's where those silly words fade out. You hear Ringo's drum break, Mean Mr. That could have easily been edited. Mm-hmm. Yet it was apparently recorded as one continuous piece. In the original version of the song, Mustard had a sister named Shirley, but on this recording, Lennon changed it to Pam because he saw that he had the opportunity to segue this into the song Polythene Pam. Originally, the songs were totally unrelated. So just by changing Shirley to Pam, all of a sudden, it gave the implication that they were somehow connected. As eventually recorded, Mustard originally was to end in the chord of D major. This is interesting. And that chord of D major, by the way, that's what you hear at the very beginning of the track Her Majesty. There's that long pause, and then you hear this really loud band chord and then Paul singing Her Majesty.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that D major chord that you're hearing there was actually the end of Mean Mr. Mustard. That was how that track was ending. The reason was that was going to lead into the next track of Her Majesty, because that's where it was originally placed in the medley. However, since the latter song was moved to the end of the album, Mustard instead was hard edited into Polythene Pam. So there is where you've got a hard edit. Although that one sounds smooth as can be. Funny. Track Polythene Pam, another Lennon composition. Here's what Lennon had to say about it in the year before he had been shot. He goes, "That was me remembering a little event with a woman in Jersey and a man who was England's answer to Allen Ginsberg. I met him when we were on tour, and he took me back to his apartment. And I had a girl, and he had one he wanted me to meet. He said she dressed in polythene, which she did. She didn't wear jack boots and kilts. I just sort of elaborated. Perverted sex in a polythene bag, so to speak. Just looking for something to write about. The song is sung in a very strong Liverpoolian accent. Polythene, by the way, is a British variant on the word polyethylene for simply a plastic vinyl type of material. Both of those songs are dismissed by John as just, quote, a piece of crap that I wrote in India." He says that about Mean Mr. Mustard and Polythene Pam. When Polythene Pam comes to an end, it segues into She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. Always seemed like a silly song lyrically. As it turns out, it's based upon real life events. McCartney said the song was actually inspired by Apple Scruffs. Apple Scruffs were the fans that always hung outside of the Abbey Road studio waiting for the Beatles to come in and leave. And they would occasionally also hang outside their homes for the exact same reason, hoping to see them coming and going. George would eventually write a song called Apple Scruffs about the girls that would hang out. Anyway, one day they broke into McCartney's St. John's Wood home. Jessica Samuels, one of the group, says, quote, "We were bored, he was out, and so we decided to pay him a visit. We found a ladder in his garden and stuck it up at the bathroom window, which he'd left slightly open. I was the one who climbed up and got in. She then opened the front door to let the others in, and they raided his wardrobe for a pair of trousers, which they took turns wearing."
Oh, Lord.
The Scruffs also stole a number of photographs. Another Apple Scruff named Margot Bird remembers being good friends with McCartney. She would often take his dog for walks. Later, she even got a job at Apple Corps, which is when McCartney basically asked her to retrieve some of the photographs that were stolen, which she did. So, I never knew that that was a true story.
How about that?
She Came In Through the Bathroom Window segues into Golden Slumbers. That was actually a song that was based on a poem called Cradle Song, which was a lullaby by a writer of drama called Thomas Dekker. The poem appears in his 1603 comedy, Patient Gristle. McCartney saw sheet music for his lullaby when he visited his father's home in Liverpool, though it was left on a piano by his stepsister, Ruth. McCartney's unable to read music, so reading the words, he simply created his own music around the words that he saw on the piano. McCartney uses the first stanza of the original poem with a few minor word changes, adding to it a single lyric repeated with minor variation. Abbey Road does not credit Dekker with the stanza or with the title, Golden Slumbers. As that track ends, it folds into Carry That Weight. Carry That Weight is one of the rare songs that actually feature vocals from all four of the Beatles, all singing on the track together. This is the track that also reprises the beginning of You Never Give Me Your Money with different lyrics this time around. Interpretation of the song. Let's see. Music critic Ian McDonald interpreted the lyric as an acknowledgement of the group that nothing they would do as individual artists would equal what they had achieved together, and that they would always carry the weight of their legacy as Beatles. McCartney said that the song really was about the Beatles' business difficulties and the atmosphere at Apple at the time, but in the film Imagine, John Lennon talks about it sort of closely to what Ian McDonald was saying that McCartney was actually singing about all of us in that song. As that ends, the track then segues naturally into the end. Very interestingly, it was the last song recorded collectively by all four Beatles. The only work that they would do after recording the end would be bits and pieces that they would do separately but not together. McCartney said, "I wanted the medley to end with a little meaningful couplet, so I followed the bard and wrote a couplet." In his 1980 interview with Playboy, Lennon acknowledged McCartney's authorship by saying, "That's Paul again." He had a line in it, "And in the end, the love you get is equal to the love you give." It's amazing that Lennon got the line wrong, but he, which is a very cosmic, philosophical line, which again proves that if he wants to, he can think.
Wow. He's brutal.
He really can be. McCartney, Harrison, and Lennon on the track, The End, toward the end of the track, perform a rotating sequence of 3 2-bar guitar solos. They start less than a minute into the song and just before the final piano part. Lennon describes it again, in a 1970 interview that he gave to Rolling Stone. "There's a nice little bit I played on Abbey Road. Paul gave us each a piece, a little break where Paul plays, then George plays, and I play. The first 2 bars are played by McCartney, the second 2 by Harrison, and the third 2 by Lennon, then the sequence repeats. Each has a distinctive style, which McCartney felt reflected each of their personalities. McCartney's playing includes a lot of string bends, sort of like the lead guitar work that he did way back on the Help album on a track, Another Girl, where he played lead. And Lennon plays with that stinging style, sort of like pulled from, Harrison, solo, incorporated the melodic yet technically advanced slide style that was beginning to become his trademark. And of course, Lennon had this really snarling, rough, tough sound, sort of like almost like a Jimi Hendrix sound that he was getting out of his guitar with a lot of distortion, similar to the way he played on the track Revolution. The End was initially intended to be the final track on Abbey Road, but it is followed by Her Majesty after about 20 seconds of silence. In the first practice mix of the medley, which was constructed on July 31st, Her Majesty, as you stated earlier, followed Mean Mr. Mustard. And on the released version of the album, as I said, Her Majesty actually begins with the excised final chord of Mean Mr. Mustard. According to sound engineer John Kurlander, McCartney said, "I don't like Her Majesty, throw it away." Kurlander cut it out, but said, "I'd been told never to throw anything away. So after he left, I picked it up off of the floor, put about 20 seconds of red leader tape before it, and stuck it onto the end of the edit tape. When McCartney heard Her Majesty in its new position, he liked it and decided that it should remain on the album just the way that it was placed there, with the 20 seconds of leader and with the last chord of Mean Mr. Mustard sitting right there." How much time do I have? It's 5:30. Wow.
Yep.
Okay, let's read a couple of quotes and then we'll move on as quickly as we can. Here's Paul now. "I think it was my idea to put all the spare bits together, but I'm a bit wary of claiming these things. I'm happy for it to be everyone's idea. Anyway, in the end, we hit upon the idea of medleying them all and giving the second side a sort of operatic structure, which was great because it used 10 or 12 unfinished songs in a good way." John: "We always have tons of bits and pieces lying around. I've got stuff that I wrote around Pepper because you lose interest in it a bit after you've had it for years. It was a good way of getting rid of bits and songs. In fact, George and Ringo wrote bits of songs as we did it, literally, in between bits and breaks too. Paul would say, 'We've got 12 bars here, fill it in.' And we'd fill it in on the spot." Paul: "John had a bit called Polythene Pam, which was based on a girl he'd met a long time ago through the poet Royston Ellis, a friend of ours in Liverpool. We'd re-met him down south and we got out on tour somewhere like Shrewsbury. He just showed up at the gig. John had gone out to dinner with him and back to his flat afterwards, and there was a girl there who apparently had polythene around her. He came back with all these tales about a girl who dressed in polythene. We thought, oh, wow, how weird, and eventually he wrote the song." John: "Polythene Pam was me remembering a little event with a woman in Jersey. She didn't..." Oh, I already read that quote, so I can skip that. Paul: "I had a couple of bits and pieces that weren't finished. There were songs that needed maybe a middle or a second verse or an end. I was playing the piano in Liverpool in my dad's house on my stepsister's Roost piano book. That's how we came up with Golden Slumbers. We covered that also." George: regarding the lyrics of You Never Give Me Your Money. Funny paper, that's what we get. We get bits of paper saying how much is earned and what this is and that is, but we never actually get it in pounds, shillings, and pence. We've all got a big house and a car and an office, but to actually get the money we've earned seems impossible. Paul, we used to ask, am I a millionaire yet? And they used to say cryptic things like, on paper you are. And we'd say, well, what does that mean? Am I or aren't I? Are there more than a million of those green things in my bank yet? And they'd say, well, it's not actually in a bank. We think you are. It was actually very difficult to get anything out of these people, and the accountants never made you feel successful. John, my contribution to that is Polythene Pam, Sun King, Mean Mr. Mustard. We juggled them about until it made sense. In Mean Mr. Mustard, I said his sister Pam. Originally, it was Shirley. I changed it to Pam to make it sound like it had something to do with it. They're the only finished bits of crap that I wrote in India, as I said. When we came to sing it, to make them different, we started joking, saying, Quando para mucha, we just made it up. We used to call ourselves Los Paranoias, so that had something to do with them, like fooling around with the Spanish language. Paul talks a little bit about three guitar solos, where John, George, and I took a line each, which was something we'd never done before. And we finally persuaded Ringo to play a drum solo, which he'd never wanted to do. And it climaxed with, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. John, a very cosmic, philosophical line. Ringo, real quick about the solo then at the end. Solos have never interested me. That drum solo was still the only one I've done. There's the guitar section where the three of them take in the solos, and then they thought, well, we have to have a drum solo as well. I was opposed to it. I don't want to do no bloody solo. George Martin convinced me. As I was playing it, he counted it because we needed a time. It was the most ridiculous thing. I was going dum-dum, one, two, three, four, and had to come off at that strange place because it was 13 bars long. Anyway, I did it, and it's out of the way. I'm pleased now that we've got one down. A side on Abbey Road, just a personal thing of mine. This is Ringo. The drum sound on the record was the result of having new calf heads. There's a lot of tom-tom work on that record. I got the new heads on the drum, and I naturally used them a lot. They were so great. The magic of real records is that they showed tom-toms was so good. I don't believe that magic is there now because there's so much more manipulation. Well, I'm going to stop here just to make sure we get in all the music, and we'll see where this takes us. Here, then, in its absolute entirety, is side two from the album Abbey Road.
Here comes the sun, here comes the sun, I say it's all right. All right. once there's a way to get back homeward. Once there's a way to get back home. Sleep pretty, darling, do not cry, and I will sing a lullaby. Sing a lullaby. Once there was a way to get back homeward. Once there was a way to get back home. Sleep pretty, darling, do not cry, I will sing a lullaby. We'll be right back.
Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. My Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I wanna tell her that I love her a lot, but I gotta get a belly full of wine. My Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah. Someday I'm gonna make her mine.
There it is. It's funny to know all the little information about it and then hear it for the first time after knowing all of that. I guess you could say that those moments of silence between the track was almost like an homage to the band. It's a sad but a beautifully fitting ending and a very beautiful way for the Beatles to end their career. A few quotes about the sessions. George was saying, during the album, things got a bit more positive, and although we had some overdubs, we got to play. We put them in order with the medley, playing the backing track, and recorded it all in one take, going from one arrangement to the next. We did actually perform more like musicians again. Likewise with the vocal tracks. We had to rehearse a lot of harmonies and learn all the backup parts. Some songs are good with just one voice and the harmonies coming in at different places, sometimes three-part work. It's just embellishment, really. And I suppose we made up parts where we thought it fitted because we were all trying to be singers again. George Martin, the producer. I tried with Paul to get back into the old Pepper way of creating something really worthwhile, and we put together the long side. John objected very much to what we did on the second side of Abbey Road, which is almost entirely Paul and I working together, with contribution from the others. John was always a teddy boy. He was a rock and roller and wanted a number of individual tracks, so we compromised. But even on the second side, you know, John helped. He would come and put his little bit in and have an idea for seeing a bit of music into the tapestry. Everybody worked frightfully well, and that's why I'm very proud of it. John again. We don't have conceptions. An album to me is a bunch of records that you can't have. I like singles myself. I think Paul has conceptions of albums, or attempts it, like he conceived the medley thing. I'm not interested in conceptions of albums. All I'm interested in is the sound. I like it to be whatever happens. I'm not interested in making the album into a show. For me, I'd just put 14 rock songs on. And to wrap it up, John again. I'll tell you honestly, I don't remember it, because Abbey Road for me, as always with all the albums, I like some of the tracks and I don't like other tracks. That's always been the same. I've never been a knocked-out Beatle fan by any of our albums. I like some of the work we do and some of it I don't. Abbey Road was a competent album. I don't think it was anything more than that or anything less. Final words then to the producer, George Martin. Nobody knew for sure that it was going to be the last album, but everybody felt it was. The Beatles had gone through so much and for such a long time. They'd been incarcerated with each other for nearly a decade, and I was surprised that they had lasted as long as they did. I wasn't at all surprised that they'd split up, because all they wanted to do was to lead their own lives, and I did too. It was a release for me as well. With that, it all comes to an end. We will be back next week with the postscript, talking about what goes on after, well, post-Beatles, post-Abbey Road, and, of course, on upward and onwards. Thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoyed our hour together. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.